history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are untold stories right there around you that really should not remain untold. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always find that we learn so much. We're educated, we're also entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The final year of World War II was so eventful around the globe, and if you've been paying attention lately, you've been hearing about it because of the timing. 75th anniversaries of milestone moments have been happening left and right, and there are some significant ones to come between now and next August. Every engagement at sea, on land, or in the air during that immense worldwide conflict provides another layer for that big picture. And if we zoom in even further, as we typically do on this show, we see how individuals experience these world-changing moments, which of course would become life-changing moments for them. Frequently, in the midst of tragic circumstances, we find stories that give us hope, stories of survival, of dodging death, of resilience, perseverance, and victory. 75 years ago this week, the world was, of course, inflamed in catastrophe. Families in every corner of America had blue stars hanging in the window, hoping they would not receive the devastating news that would turn a blue star to gold. Half a world away, in the Philippine Sea, a massive assemblage of American firepower was taking aim at Japanese installations on Taiwan, known then as Formosa. 17 American aircraft carriers, 6 battleships, 4 heavy cruisers, 11 light cruisers, and nearly 60 destroyers were all in that vicinity as part of Task Force 38. A typhoon had just moved through the area, so seas were still pretty rough, and the opposition was rougher. Japanese planes relentlessly attacked the fleet, and nearly 90 American aircraft were lost, but out of all those ships I listed, almost 100 of them, only 2 suffered heavy damage in that 5-day battle, and none of them went under, which is pretty remarkable. We're going to focus today on the story of one ship, the USS Houston, and eventually one man aboard that ship. But first, I think we need to provide some context. In today's Navy, there's a submarine named the USS Houston. In World War I, there was a cargo ship with that name. But in World War II, there were 2 ships named the Houston, both cruisers. The first one fought successfully in the Battle of the Java Sea in February 1942, which was, to that point, the largest surface engagement of the war. Just days later, though, while sailing in the Sunda Strait in Indonesia, which the Navy believed was clear of enemy vessels, the Houston was struck after midnight by 1 torpedo, then slammed again by 3 more in succession. It sank quickly in the middle of the night, so in the perspective of the rest of the Navy at the time, it just disappeared. It became known as the Galloping Ghost of the Java Coast. The full story wouldn't be told until after World War II ended 3.5 years later, when surviving prisoners of war explained that about a third of the crew, 368 men, had survived and been captured by the Japanese, but the rest, nearly 700, were killed that fateful night. This was less than 4 months into America's involvement in World War II, and as far as anyone knew, a 1,000 American sailors had just vanished. So how do you respond to such a devastating situation? Well, at the end of May 1942, 1,000 new sailors were sworn in Houston, Texas, labeled the Houston Volunteers, ostensibly replacing the men lost on that still unaccounted-for ship. In October of that year, a cruiser called the Vicksburg was renamed in honor of the missing ship, with President Franklin D. Roosevelt saying, quote, "Our enemies have given us the chance to prove that there will be another USS Houston, and yet another USS Houston if that becomes necessary, and still another USS Houston as long as American ideals are in jeopardy." That second cruiser, Houston, wouldn't see action until 1944. And 75 years ago this week, in that Battle of Formosa, it nearly suffered the same fate as its namesake. The pattern of that battle had Americans launching air raids against Japanese installations on Formosa during the day, with the enemy targeting American warships at night. On the night of October 14th, 4 torpedo planes took aim at the Houston, and one of them snuck through to land a direct hit to the engine room, resulting in a loss of propulsive power. In a bit, minute, we're going to hear the memory of a man who was actually steering the ship in that moment and find out how he experienced it. But first, some background on just how remarkable it is that the Houston survived that blow and another torpedo strike that would occur two nights later. Let's listen to a recording made way back in 1971 by the U.S. Naval Institute's Oral History Program. I have their website linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. This is Rear Admiral George Miller, who, when this attack occurred, was a damage control officer aboard the Houston.
The great majority of the people on board the ship were in a state of shock, and the ship was helpless. Everything was dead, the engines. We had no power to our gun. Lying to, listing, deep in the water, decks awash, starboard deck awash. The ship was literally helpless. It was a liability to the commander of the task force at the time. We were 75 miles off Formosa, less than 70 miles perhaps. The Japanese were still attacking. The Bettys were everywhere. We could see them. They came in low. They came past us. I believe they fired a couple torpedoes at us after the first one hit. The task force commander wanted to get out of there and make some distance between, put some distance between himself and the position where he was in by daylight. I was down in damage control, of course, when the Houston was hit, and I went through my routine testing. My people down there tested all stations and soon realized that after boiler room and engine and the forward engine room flooded immediately, that the forward fire room was flooding rapidly and had to be abandoned, and that the after engine was also flooding, could not be controlled. So I then ordered the damage control efforts to confining the flooding within the boundaries of the engineering, main engineering space of the forward compartment. As reports began to come in, I found that the third deck above the after fire room and forward engine room, the armor plate had been breached and that the second deck was flooding. I then ordered them to confine the flooding in the second deck, the spaces directly above the after fire room and the forward. Now I had, I realized, a quick calculation, more water on board, probably more water on board, at least as much water on board as the battleship Deerfing in World War I. More water on board in comparison with our displacement than any other ship that survived in World War II.
I realize some of it may be hard to hear. This recording was made nearly 50 years ago, but I wanted to draw attention to that last statement, that the Houston had more water on board in comparison to its displacement than any other ship that survived World War II. That alone tells you how close it was to capsizing. Remember, this is all unfolding in the dark of the night as well, and over 1,200 men aboard are trying to figure out what the future might hold for them.
I was unable to reach the bridge. They were busy with other things. So that when I had given all the instructions about confining the bounds of floodwater, I left, crew and I left the damage control, and I ordered the crew out of the main fire control, which was adjacent to us, and up to the second deck, and advised my people. Damage control was shifting to the forward station, the second deck. When I got to the second deck, I learned by word of mouth that we'd been given orders to abandon ship. Found at that time that ship, including the bridge, were all in the process of preparing to abandon and to abandon ship. I seemed to be able to have very little help in working the damage control problem. I was able to identify a very few key people, and I'll name them. It's Julius Stuckert, a lieutenant, a phlegmatic, introverted lieutenant, who was my damage control assistant. He says, "What do you want me to do, boss?" I sent Joe Simpson and Carpenter Schnabel to the after part of the ship to check on the flooding boundaries, to ensure that they were holding, and to begin shoring the second deck in the area where it had been breached, because the second deck was now flooding rapidly, and that was the center of the ship, and that the forward and after bulkheads, flooded area, were bulging. So I asked that they be shored and that the flooding boundaries be watched for any evidence of extended flooding. I told Charlie York and Julius Stuckert to go forward and prepare for towing. I then went to the bridge to report to the captain what I had done, and the captain brushed me aside and said, "George, we're in order to abandon ship." I then went to the after part of the bridge and talked to the executive officer, and I said, I'm not going to abandon ship. I said, I think this ship can be saved. I want to stay. And he listened for a while, and he said, all right, let's go back to the captain. Back we went. The captain kept asking me if I was sure the ship could survive for the night. And I said, no, I'm not sure, but I think it's worth a try. With a little luck, it will survive. And this discussion went on for quite some time. And when the captain understood my feeling about abandoning the ship, that I was going to stay, he then said, all right, and he went back to the task force commander, and I said, we must have a tow. He said, all right, go down and prepare for towing, and I'll try to get someone to tow it. And so I went down to the forecastle. Meanwhile, destroyers were coming alongside, and while the ship was rolling heavily, people were going into, the crew was going into the water. They were abandoning ship. In our efforts to prepare for a tow, we had very little help from those who were in charge of forward decks, those who were in charge of the forepart of the ship. It was very dark, the ship was rolling very heavily. Occasionally, the starboard side of the deck would receive a large wave, and it would work its way down onto the second deck. So that as we continually had the problem of keeping the watertight doors of the main deck secured, because flooding was still continuing. Before I left damage control, it looked to me like the ship would capsize. Now, as I recall, we had calculated that if the ship rolled more than, I believe, 37 and a half degrees, with the kind of water we had aboard that would go over, I believe that our maximum roll did indeed reach 37 and a half degrees to starboard, and the ship did capsize. But the problem was that as long as you had your big engine compartments partially flooded, you had what you call free surface. Free surface gives you a dangerous stability situation. As I watched the roll, I noticed that as she settled deeper in the water and the big compartments filled to the top, that the roll subsided somewhat. Before I left the damage control, I felt that at least the ship would not capsize. The other thing, as the ship settled, the big longitudinals were beginning to buckle because of the weight. The buoyancy was in the bow of the stern. Before I reported the bridge, we had to appraise that. It was very dangerous to go and look at these longitudes because rivets were flying at the speed of bullets. They were flying throughout the area, and it looked like, literally, the ship was going to break in half. It looked to me at first, the keel itself had been severed.
So that gives you a picture of how close the Houston was to going under, how miraculous it may be that it did not. Things didn't look so good for the light cruiser USS Houston 75 years ago this week, did they? That was George H. Miller, damage control officer aboard the Houston that day, who would go on to become an admiral, thanks to the U.S. Naval Institute's oral history program for that decades-old audio. And now let's dig into a much more recent interview with a man who was aboard that day. Jonas Hofer passed away a couple years ago at the age of 93. In 2014, he shared his remarkable story here on Hometown Heroes. He was a teenaged member of the ship's original crew.
My duties was working with the navigation department. I was a bugle master, so I had five buglers, but I didn't have to get up early in the morning to do it. The five would do that. And then I was in the navigation branch. There's 13 of us in there, and I would steer the ship 1 hour out of four when I was on duty. So I was a helmsman. Actually, I was at the helms when the first torpedo hit, and the ship just raised out of the water and dropped. And I had a helmet on, and my helmet got jammed down on my head.
Let's set the scene for this. So you're taking your turn at the helm, and people hear torpedo, they assume that's a submarine, but these were actually planes, torpedo bomber planes that were coming. Did you have any idea they were in the area?
We had 40 of them in the air that time, and in fact, after our ship was torpedoed and I was in the water and the battle was still going, oh no, I was still aboard ship, I counted 13 airplanes burning in the water at one time. And maybe 10 of them were Japanese and maybe 3 of them were in that there. So it was, if you've ever been in a battle like that, there's smoke and noise and of course your own ship get hit. It's terrible. You can't, but you do what you have to do. You know, you don't panic. You keep on working at that, hoping it won't hit you.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, because here
What are you, 19, 20 years old at that point?
I was 18, yeah. I was 18 when I was a survivor. But I remember then we were going and airplanes were going over the ships and dropping torpedoes and that. And a torpedo came toward us and the captain saw it. So the captain says, right 30 degrees rudder, which is white over. So I spun the wheel over it, and it was coming in like this, and we were turning in at it, but we didn't get soon enough. It was too close. This airplane had come over another ship and then was between us, so they couldn't fire at him about 20 feet off the water, and then we couldn't fire at him, and he dropped the fish, and then he went off, and we shot him down. But it was too late then.
So you turned into the path of the torpedo.
Right, yeah. There had been a typhoon through there 2 days before, so the ship was rolling quite then. So the torpedo broke the ship's keel. In the ship there is a keel that's about 10 feet high, maybe 12 inches of steel, both like an I-beam, goes the whole length of the ship. That was broken. So the ship was like that there. So the captain, we thought the ship was going to break in half. So the captain said to check with all the other officers. An hour later, he says, abandon ship. Well, I was waiting and didn't get off right away. I was me and the other guy, Dwight, who had this navigator's Bible study. We were together waiting, and the guys were jumping off the side, and the boats were all going off and that. When an hour later, the captain, one of the officers told him, maybe we can save the ship. So the captain reversed his abandoned ship. But by that time, we had 1,000 guys leave already. So there was maybe 250. I have a picture of it here.
So it was a pretty skeleton crew on a wounded ship.
The ship, the bottom was, of course, there were probably 40, 50 guys in the engineering were all killed right off bat. Because they were underwater and that there. And the ship was down so far in the water and that there that we had no food. So the Phoenix, another cruiser, came by and gave us sandwiches. And that's what this is. We're eating the first time that day.
So this is a photograph while the Houston is still afloat. It's been torpedoed once. And you're still on board. And you're saying, okay, time to eat lunch.
Yes. And what happened then, a seagoing tug came out and hooked onto us and started pulling us away from Formosa toward Ulithi.
And we're going to leave things right there as we grab our first commercial break. We've got some photos relating to this episode posted at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. 75 years ago this week, the USS Houston crippled by that torpedo attack. It was about to be struck again. And we'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode today dedicated to what was unfolding 75 years ago off of Taiwan, known then as Formosa in the Philippine Sea. the USS Houston, a ship renamed in tribute to another cruiser that had vanished in the middle of the night 2 years earlier, was itself staring at a fate similar to its namesake's. In fact, if you're into the details and you'd like to read the official damage report from the USS Houston's torpedoing, I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It was a unique case study because most ships that were struck by a torpedo where the Houston was, it detonated against the bottom amidships midway between the centerline keel and the starboard bilge keel, most of them wouldn't be available to study because they'd be at the bottom of the sea. That torpedo hit right as the Houston was listing to port during a high-speed turn. And you heard the man executing that turn, helmsman Jonas Hofer, explain what he experienced. The captain gave the abandon ship order, and about 80% of the crew did abandon ship. A skeleton crew remained as the Houston became a very slow-moving target, limping along under tow with the battle raging on around them. Once things settled down, that remaining crew carried out a burial at sea for those shipmates killed in the near sinking. And Jonas Hofer found himself right in the middle of that as well.
Well, we had a burial of about 40 guys in that time. And what we would do is then, you would, if the guy was dead, you'd check him out and you'd put an M on their forehead. And then you'd take a 5-inch shell and put it between their legs and wrap canvas around twice and sew it up. And then you'd put them on a board like this here against the ship's railing, and then I'd play taps, and they'd dump it like that, and the canvas would go out from underneath the top covering that there.
And they would slide into the water.
You couldn't haul them all in, you know, because you didn't know when you're going to come in to shore and that, and they would, our power was all out. We had no air refrigeration or that anymore. And there were about, I suppose, from 40 to 60 guys that were still in the water down there, and you couldn't get them out. This was all topside guys, and we buried 10 at a time. So we did 4 times, so I say there's 40 that were buried.
And you just answered my next question. I was putting 2 and 2 together, saying if you're the head of the bugle crew on this ship that you might have had to play taps. What was that like for a burial at sea, to be the guy where everyone's attention is on you, and you know what a somber situation this is?
I always said you didn't have to worry about vibrato. It came automatically. You had to really concentrate, you know, not to think that these are your friends that you're burying now and that you wanted to play the taps right. You had to really think about that there. And afterwards, the officers all came up and thanked you and figured, how did he keep your cool on that there? Well, I had a hard time.
And he would have to keep his cool again on October 16th, 1944, when, 2 days after the initial torpedo strike, the crippled cruiser was struck again.
A Betty, a Japanese plane, twin-engine plane, came and followed the oil slick, which is in the water, and then came out on the side and came in, dropped the torpedo, and we had no guns except 20 millimeter that was on the main deck, maybe 20 of those. And those guys opened up and they got the airplane, but here the fish was down the water, right? And the second torpedo hit under the hangar deck in back where our two airplanes were and just broke that all up. Luckily, we had a small fire there, but it did not get into the gasoline, so we were saved that way. But we did have some fires and that aboard ship.
So at this point, you're still thinking that this ship is going to make it. But I know I'm bouncing around on you here. Before you pick it up there, I think a lot of people are saying, man, a teenager at the wheel of a ship in battle with torpedoes coming at you, getting hit by torpedoes, listening to the captain, seeing what's going on. Were you nervous? Were you scared? What in the world does that feel like?
No, you just follow orders because you've been steering the ship otherwise than that there. If he says 30 degrees right rudder, full right rudder, left to that, or come to 278, you'd say 278, you'd come to it and says, sir, we're on 278, tell him that. So you just reported. The officer wasn't, he could get, because he could see the torpedoes coming in. And the second one, of course, we knew when this Betty dropped that torpedo, we're going to get hit because it was so close.
Did you actually see it?
We saw the trail in the water, yeah, coming right at us. And, of course, we were dead in the water then. That was the second.
Yeah, you're being pulled along by a tug, going very slow.
And our steering aft, the steering was out, so they manually got it, the rudder straightened out, and that's where it was at. We couldn't. The engineering and that was all underwater. So there, the guys were still in there.
So when you saw that torpedo, the wake in the water coming at you.
I didn't see it, but the officer did. Yeah. The captain saw it, yeah.
Well, maybe it's better you didn't see it.
Yeah, probably. Well, I was waiting then, and he says, somebody in there, another officer, said, we're going to catch another torpedo on that then. So we kind of braced ourselves for that one. But the first one, I didn't know. When that ship lifted up and fell like that, I didn't know what happened then.
And where were you when the second one hit?
I was on the bridge. I was on the bridge watching for other airplanes and that there, reporting them, yeah.
And how long did it take after that hit before you knew this time it was abandoned ship for good?
Oh, I'd say about a half an hour after that, the captain said abandoned ship. But to this day, I don't know when I left the ship. I have tried to think of that. I've been asked about it. And I know Dyke and myself got together in the water then. And when I came to in the water, there were about 25 of us in the water and that. And you'll think this is funny, and I think it is too, is that we started singing some hymns. And the hymns I remember we sang, one of them was, "There shall be showers of blessing." Now, why would you sing a song like that? It just seems crazy to me. Why would you sing there? But I guess because most of the sailors knew that song. We sang that and some other hymns and that there in the water. And then it got dark and we got parted. And pretty soon we weren't close. And Dyke and myself, we tied ourselves together with our belts. And we were in the water. And then the next day the sun came up. During the night, we saw some ships come close. And we were afraid, and first they'd go over us, but they didn't. But we were afraid to yell out because we didn't know if they're Japanese or ours because there were so many ships in the air, Japanese and that. And we were pretty close to Formosa there too, you know, 80 miles about that time. They figure that during those 2 days, we were towed about 80 miles on the water.
Couple questions. You said when you came to in the water, so did you, and you said you don't remember when you went off the ship, did you get off the ship under your own power, or were you blown off the ship, or you don't know?
I don't know. I think I got off my own, but I can't remember going over the side of the ship. And then it was after I was in the water, Dyke swam up to me, and I recognized him, so we tied ourselves together with our belts, and then we wanted to stay together.
And did you have a Mae West or any kind of flotation device?
I had two of them. I had a Mae West, and then I had the other one, which is a rubber one that has a little hand. You pull it, and it blows up, and it goes underneath you. The Mae West, after 3 hours, was worthless. It was taking us down that night. And so we both took our Mae West and just dropped them. They sunk, actually. But these rubber ones we had, those were good. Those stayed. And they, if they went down and had a leak in them, they also had something you could blow them. And that's what kept us up till the next day, yeah.
How many hours were you in the water?
Between 14 and 16. I don't know exactly when we went in. I know I was picked up at about 10 o'clock next morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, while the sun was going down, when we got that second torpedo. And I just don't know, like I say, I cannot reckon at all of when I went in the water. But I know there, because Dyke swam up, and we swam together and tied ourselves together, and we sang these songs in the water. I know that much. And then during the night, we got parted, you know. In the morning when we got picked up, there was nobody close to us. And the USS Grayson was still in a battle then. The ships were still fighting there again. They'd gotten into battle again. And what they did with our ship, they towed it as bait for the Japanese planes to come out, and then our battleships and those, and our pilots would shoot them down. But they missed this one Betty that came in, saw our oil slick, and came in the side and gave us the next torpedo.
I've talked to a few guys who have had to abandon ship and who have had to survive the water for some time. And in different spots, there were different hazards of the water. What did you see? What did you experience floating in the water? I mean, were there things burning around you? Were there things to hold on to? Did you have to fear sharks at all? What did you have to deal with?
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, a floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continually. But the water temperature was 87 degrees. So it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when you'd been in it over 12 hours, I think I was in it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. I was so weak from being in the water so long, and of course we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours, that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us, and then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb. I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed. And there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, they were just all quiet. There was really respect. And I really appreciate that when we, and so after I prayed, I looked up kind of and I saw these guys all standing with their hats over the like that there and looking down and that. So we were really respected because we had the Bible classes, I think. I think that's why. I don't think they would have done it otherwise.
And along those lines, maybe some folks aren't familiar with what the navigators were as they were founded during that time period. How extensive was that program on your ship?
Well, the officers and the captain was for ours, for us having those there. Because they figured that the more guys that followed the Bible, the less problems they'd have in shore patrol and stuff like that, which was right, yeah. So we would have every Monday night from 8 till 9 o'clock, we would have Bible studies and verse go over some of the verse memorized the guys were, and find out how they're getting along in their Christian life and that. Of course, we had a lot of booze. You know, the guys called us old preachers and Bible thumpers, and they had a whole bunch of names. But in the wall, in the water there, they swam up to us and were all very good to us and that. And even aboard ship, like I say, while we prayed there and that there, of course, they realized, well, here these eight guys were just saved out of the water and that there, so they have something to be thankful for. And we were. And then what you did in your Bible studies and that, we started a Timothy program, which the navigators did. You would take one guy out from the other sailors and that, and you would work with him for about 6 months and just tutor him and get him into the Bible study and that. And then 6 months later, he did it too, so you were doubled. Dawson Trotman had it figured out that if everybody would do this every 2 years, get two like this, and then four, and then 16, in 13 years, everybody in the world would have been a navigator. Well, some of the guys never did, so you fall through that there. We started out with the two of us and started, and by the time the ship was sunk, we had about 30. We had about 30 guys that came to our meetings every Monday night. And that.
And there's quite a story behind those weekly meetings, too. We're going to hear that when we come back. Everything you're hearing about today was unfolding in real time 75 years ago in the Philippine Sea off of Formosa. Check out the photos and additional links online at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated this week to what some have referred to as the miraculous survival of the cruiser USS Houston 75 years ago this week in the Battle of Formosa. Torpedoed not once, but twice, it rolled beyond what was thought to be its sinking point, took on more water in relation to its displacement than any other ship that made it through the war, and somehow it did not sink. Jonas Hofer did not abandon ship after the first torpedo strike on October 14, 1944. He was ordered to abandon ship 2 days later, and he spent the next 14 to 16 hours in the water. I don't think you expected to hear him say that the first thing he did when connecting with other survivors in the water was to start singing hymns, but by now you figured out that faith was a big part of his story. Jonas had survived a near-fatal car crash as a teenager that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He had bars installed in his home and spent the next year swinging around the house like a monkey until, amazingly, his spine straightened out and the use of his legs returned. He even did some bodybuilding and became a championship pole vaulter, but at the age of 17, he enlisted in the Navy, and at age 18, he was steering the cruiser Houston when that first enemy torpedo crippled the ship. You heard him refer to the Bible study that he and another sailor led aboard the ship, but the story of how that originated and the obstacles they had to overcome is pretty unique, too.
I worked with the chaplain, and I read a lot of books. So he had me help in the library. So we got crowded. There was about eight of us down in our little, where our bunks were at and that, and where we got together for prayer and that. And so Dyke said, why don't you go ask the chaplain, you work in the library some, if we could use the ship's lounge. The ship's lounge had about 30 seats in there. And so I went and asked the chaplain, and the chaplain says, what makes you think we need Bible studies aboard ship? I said, well, everybody can gain with Bible studies then. Have you been to a seminary? I said, no, I've been to no seminary. Well, I forbid you to teach then. He says, without the seminary training, then how can you know the Bible? I said, I've studied it all my life and that there. He says, well, I forbid you. So 2 days later, I was steering the ship when the captain came up and says, Hofer, what's your problem with the chaplain? Why? He said, he put you on report, captain's report. That's like you have a small court and the captain judges you and that. The only thing I can figure out, I asked him to use the ship's lounge. And he says, what for? And I says, for these Bible studies and navigator material. And he says, I will forbid you. And I says, if I can't have Bible study, I'm in the wrong Navy. The captain says, well, when do you meet? I says, we meet on Monday nights. This was about a Wednesday or Thursday. And he says, have your next meeting in the ship's lounge. I'll be there. Wagner will be there, the other officer, and the chaplain. But do the meeting the way you always do them. Don't change anything. Just do them that way. Okay. Well, it was my turn to have the meeting. We took turns. I did more praying that week. Went to the meeting. We had our meeting regular. Captain was there. Wagner was there, administrative officer, and the chaplain, and about 15 guys in that day. because it was a little beer, and because of more room, they wanted to see what was going on. So afterwards, they saluted and left the net. The next day on the bulletin board in the ship was, from now on Monday night, there will be a navigators meeting in the ship's lounge. From 8 till 9, the smoking lamp will be out. There will be no gambling aboard ship between 8 and 9. You're all invited, and Hofer and Dyke are holding the meeting and using navigator material. So it just turned around. Then something else happened. 2 weeks later, Captain said, I remember I was steering the ship when he said, told the executive officer, says, we'll have communion Sunday. Says, go get the wine and everything. So he came back, Wagner came back a little while later. We have no communion wine aboard ship. Captain says, that's funny. I signed for 8 gallons in Sydney, Australia, just 2 weeks ago when we were down there. You check again. He went and checked. Well, he says, I finally came back about 20 minutes later. He says, I found out that the chaplain and two Marines had drank all the communion wine. A week later, here another ship came up close. They put a boatswain chair, which on a rope over. And the chaplain was leaving, sent back to the United States. So we didn't have a chaplain a month later when the ship was torpedoed.
Well, that's a great story. And I'm impressed with the courage and the follow-through you showed there. I imagine that was a little intimidating situation there for a while, but it must have felt really good to see how it worked out.
Yeah, it was, but we knew who was in charge. Yeah, man, it was the good Lord was in charge. And this Herman Dyke was not a normal sailor. He would push, boy. He wouldn't take no for an answer. And so we just kept on with it. I don't know. It never bothered me when the sailors called me preachers and virgins and Bible thumpers and all. Didn't bother me a bit. But it was sure good in the water to know that they respected you then. And you're the same ones. And I had found in the Navy, usually the hardest guy was the first guy you could win. It seemed like the guy that wanted to take you out and get you drunk and tattooed and all that there was the first guy that would actually, when he changed, would really change. You know? The one that was really real to me when I was in the water was because I had seen, you know, when we got the first torpedo, there were probably 4,000 men in the water because Houston, there was 1,000. Canberra was another 1,200. There were two destroyers sunk then, and another one was the seagoing tug and that. So there could have been 3,000 to 4,000 guys in the water and that there. And here, 8 of us were picked up only out of that, all of those. And then the captain got out of there because that torpedo went on. So then later on the Kula Gulf, I started with another guy. We started the Navigator program on that. Of course, in those days, there's altogether different atom in the Navy. I'd say about 50% of the sailors at one time or other went to a Sunday school or something then. A lot of them came from the Midwest. And so it was just natural for them to be interested. And we had a lot of Catholics, sure, that were with us on that, probably more Catholics than anything else that would study with us and that. And then one of the verses I learned, the whole chapter of Psalm 91, but it starts about in 7, 8, and 9, it says, 1,000 shall fall at thy side and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee, because thou hast made the Lord, even the Most High, thy habitation. I took that verse kind of as my own, and I had seen 1,000 guys in the water, you know, picked up on the Japanese, a lot of them, and different camps than that there. And here, 8 of us are picked up, kind of like a miracle, you know. Yeah.
Almost sounds like that verse was written with you in mind.
Yeah. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will save the Lord. He is my God. Him will I trust.
While you're in the water, 14, 15, 16 hours, that's a long time to be in the water. During that time, did you ever fear that you wouldn't get picked up or that you might get picked up by the wrong side?
No, I don't know why. To this day, when I think back how I felt then, I always felt to be picked up by the U.S. I just had, maybe I was just too young to be scared. there. I just planned all night that the next day when got light we could see what ships were around. And we didn't do it, but a lot of them, when they were in the water, and if they came over and strafed, then they would get under the water, in the water, until the plane went over and that. We never had to do any of that. Nobody strafed us or came after us. Of course, we were out there by ourselves. I couldn't see another sailor as far as you could look on the waves and that there when we got picked up. But there were 8 of us picked up, so that boat took about a half a mile round like that there. And the destroyer just kept going about 20 miles an hour so they wouldn't get torpedoed. And then the boat came close, and the ship never stopped. It kept going while the guys were getting us on, and then they got out of there. I never feared that we weren't going to get picked up in that. The big ships wouldn't stop for you. The battle wagons, cruisers, and them, they couldn't afford to stop. They had too many guys aboard ship, you know. And that's when you get torpedoed the easiest and that. Yeah. So they would keep patrolling at 25 miles an hour. But then the small ships, destroyer escorts and them, the Phoenix was a cruiser that picked up about 25. And then when we came back to the States, there were about 100 of us on this old bucket, the SS Typhoon from Australia to Hawaii, but they had been picked up and other ships were coming in. So in San Francisco we had very few guys picked up by the Japanese from our ship, because the battle was going and the Japanese couldn't spend time picking up people either. We went to Hawaii, and Hawaii gave us a month's survivor's leave at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel.
Tough assignment.
Yes. And they gave us surfboards to use, golfing clubs and all that for a month. I didn't know I was in the Navy then. The day after that month was over, we were in the Navy again, heading for the States. Then we got to Treasure Island, and for 3 weeks we were on there, and they were getting our written reports. And then I got another month's survivor's leave at home. Got to go fishing with some cousins and that. And then I went back. I was assigned to the Kula Gulf and had to go up to Bremerton, Washington, where I caught this ship here.
Well, you mentioned another month of survivor's leave at home. Did you tell your mother everything you'd been through? How did that go when you saw her again? And
no, well, just that we had been swimming. No, you didn't. You didn't tell your mother very much at all, because she wouldn't want you to go again, that's for sure. But she knew it was rough. We had a plan. My mother knew always where I was at. I had bought 2 maps when I was home, and I put numbers by 40 of those different spots throughout the world. Casablanca, a few over there, but most of them South Pacific, because I figured we'd be there. And so when I wrote her a letter, and maybe I'd write in there, oh, I saw the funniest thing. There was a guy that was 38 pounds, and that meant 38 watts, walking down the street, and he was a little pygmy, and he weighed only 38 pounds, but he was walking like a grown man. Well, she took that 38, went to the map. Oh, that's this island here. That's Guam. And so they knew where I was at by my letters and that. Of course, sometimes it took your letters 2 or 3 weeks to get home.
But you found a way to beat those censors who would have cut that information out if you had spelled it out.
In your letters, you know, there would be big black spots that they would just mark through, because all your mail was censored by the officers, yeah.
So he had that code worked out with his family, and he also had some support from his family back home. When they finally reunited, he was asked what was happening 75 years ago this week. When he answered about those days on the calendar, he received a spine-tingling response about how his mother experienced those fateful days back home, having no way of knowing exactly where he was or what he was facing.
My mother couldn't sleep that night at home. So she thought, well, I'm in the most dangerous place there is. I'm the only one in the service. So she got up and prayed for me that night. My brother was going to Biola then in Los Angeles. He couldn't sleep either. And my brother did the same thing. He couldn't figure out why did he think about me so much. must be for prayer.
Just another wrinkle in the story Jonas Hofer told for decades at the typewriter and church supply store he operated in Dinuba, California, a story he continued to tell until his passing 2 years ago. He was proud of his cruiser, the USS Houston, and the men who kept it afloat, and he was thankful for that time and every time his life was spared.
Well, you know, when we look back, we see many points in our life, or turning points. One of my big ones was when I was in high school and broke my back. And one of the biggest mistakes I made then and what it cost me. And I like to tell my children and others in that there's sometimes very little things in your life that can really change it. That changed my life where I had to be in bed there all year and thought I'd never walk again. But it got me back to my senses, and I'm thankful for that. It really made me think again of health, myself, and my good Lord. It really did. That was a turning point in my life.
That was USS Houston survivor Jonas Hofer. You can link to his original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. There aren't too many left from that ship, but they are still holding reunions. In fact, they just had their latest one last month in Louisville, Kentucky, recalling again what happened 75 years ago this week off of Formosa. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.